So I'm going to go into the first of the 10 precepts, as Ratnagosha says. Firstly, I was actually going to start my talk by discussing how important the 10 precepts are in our spiritual lives, how they sort of provide a moral code, a sort of set of training principles for leading an ethical life. So that was going to be the first page and a half of my talk, but Ratnagosha covered that last week, you know. Much more eloquently than I ever could, so we can skip that bit, so you've saved yourself 5 minutes already. However, before we do dive in, I would just like to establish that it's not the first precept by accident that I'm going to be talking about. It is arguably the most important of the 10 precepts. And of course I would say that, because I'm up here talking about it, and you know, I'm pretty competitive, so I'm thinking, yeah, this is the most important. But actually, I have a pretty powerful ally who says this. So Sangha Rachita says in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, the principle of abstention from killing living beings or love runs very deep in life, both social and spiritual, and its ramifications are not only very extensive but enormously significant. Within the specifically Buddhist context of the Ten Precepts, it is the most direct and most important manifestation of the spiritual and existential act of going for refuge. However, it is a principle that finds expression in one way or another, and to a greater or lesser degree, not only in the first precept itself, but in all the other precepts as well. For this reason, it merits our serious attention. So we're encouraged by Bante to take this precept very seriously indeed. And he warns that there's actually a potential danger that it's too obvious, that we all know that we shouldn't harm each other or others, and hence we don't give it the attention it deserves. So you all need to sit up and pay attention. So first of all, I'm going to look at the first precept in its negative form. I undertake to abstain from taking or harming life. It means honouring all life, not acting out of hatred or aversion in such a way as to cause harm to any living creature. Harming living beings is an expression of a mental state rooted in greed, hatred and delusion. And it's the negation of the solidarity between one being and another, and represents the assertion of one ego at the expense of another. In its most extreme form, killing another being is an unskillful act, because it brings suffering not only on the victim but also on the doer, holding back both from enlightenment. As Bante says again, to kill a living being means to inflict upon him the greatest of all sufferings or evils, for inasmuch as life is the greatest good, so the greatest suffering or the greatest evil that can befall one is to be deprived of life. Harming another being is also considered unskillful because it's an expression of himsa, force or violence. This violence can be mental or physical, and really means doing to another being something which that being does not want. Ahimsa, or non-violence, is the opposite and means actively trying to promote a reconciliation and love between beings, as well as refraining from acts of violence oneself. So ahimsa is described as the highest dharma, because violence is the unskillful action which does most damage and contributes most to suffering. So based on the teaching of the interdependence of all beings, of Pratitya Samuppada, we can recognise our relationship to all life and realise that harming any living creature harms oneself. As the Buddha says, identifying ourselves with others, we can never slay or cause to slay. So we can reflect on that, the equality of ourself with others, reflecting that one suffers from the same effects of samsara as any other being. And we can put ourselves in the place of others, imagine that we all experience the same pains and pleasures. And the Dhammapada highlights this. It says, all living beings are terrified of punishment, all fear death. Putting oneself in the place of others, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. All living beings are terrified of punishment, all love life. Putting oneself in the place of others, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. So that's the negative form. But I'd like to move on now to the positive form of the precept, which I think we're probably more familiar with in many ways. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. And in many ways, this is a much more inspiring format, and that's to be the focus of the rest of my talk. So Shelley says, the great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another, and of many things, the pain and pleasures of his species must become his own. So inspiring stuff, but what is loving kindness? Which is a translation of the Pali word metta. Well, over to Banti once more, who says, just as killing represents the absolute negation of another person's being, love, as we must perforce call it, represents its absolute affirmation. As such, it is not erotic love, or parental love, or even friendly love. It is, if it is love at all, it is a cherishing, protecting, maturing love, which has the same kind of effect on the spiritual being of others as the light and heat of the sun have on their own physical body. Pretty nice. I like that image. So we need to think about our own actions, both in terms of what we do, but also, perhaps more importantly, what we don't do. So for those of us who make confessions in our chapter or GFR groups, it's quite interesting that we instinctively think about what we've done that might have harmed others. We confess when we have been unskillful. But actually, by focusing on the positive form of the precept as opposed to the negative form, we can creatively reflect on what we could have done and what we could do in the future. For instance, perhaps we could think about the time we didn't help someone when perhaps that we had the opportunity. That time when we hesitated about making someone a cup of tea when they looked in need of some loving kindness, perhaps. So spotting those opportunities when we can show loving kindness takes practice. As Subhadramati says in her book, It's Not About Being Good, practicing the positive precepts takes more skill and imagination than abstaining from unskillfulness. We need to be aware of when we can take positive action. And this precept can be applied to all aspects of our lives. As Sangharakshita says in the Ten Pillars again, we should extend the principle of abstention from harming loving beings, or the principle of love, into as many different areas of life as possible, both individual and collective. So I'm going to explore how we can apply loving kindness in all aspects of our lives in more detail in a minute. But one thing I'd like to briefly explore is just the scale of what we can do. For some people, the magnitude of suffering in our world can be overwhelming. And for some, it can prevent them taking any action at all. But I don't actually think it really matters what we do, as long as we do whatever we can. So to explain a bit more about that, when putting this talk together, I remembered some work done by the author Stephen Covey, who wrote Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, a management book that was all the rage when I was working in the corporate world. One of the ideas he put forward is the theory of circles of concern and circles of influence. And so a circle of concern encompasses the wide range of concerns that we have, from our immediate friends and family, but also to the global political and ecological crisis of our current times, so the whole gamut of our worries, if you like. Our circle of influence encompasses those concerns that we can actually do something about, so they're concerns that we have some sort of control over, much smaller than the circle of concern. And our circle of concern can feel overwhelming. Not only our own problems or those of our friends and families, but all the disasters we hear about on the news, the plight of refugees in Calais and Myanmar, the homeless crisis, the need for food banks, the Syrian war, the environmental catastrophes, the list goes on and on and on. And the danger is that we just suffer horrified anxiety, which is the near enemy of compassion. We identify with the problem, we feel sorry for the people suffering, but we think the problem is just so big, so vast, that we can't do anything to change them. And so we decide not to do anything at all. But actually, even a small deed of loving kindness can make a difference. What is important is that taking control, being proactive in even seemingly small ways, is hugely empowering. And we shouldn't underestimate the influence these steps can have on others. By exemplifying our Buddhist values, we grow our circle of influence, because others will notice and take heed. We should remember the power of the ripple effect, the continuing and spreading results of an event or an action. So when we smile at one person, they feel better, and then they go and smile at someone else. And that smile radiates out from that person to others and others and others. We can be exemplars in the way that we lead our lives. And although it can be overwhelming at times, I truly believe that every small deed of loving kindness makes a difference. And it reminds me of a parable I heard recently. So a man's walking along the beach and he sees this scene of devastation ahead of him, a huge wave, a tsunami has tossed thousands and thousands of starfish onto the beach. And there they are, all stranded out of the water. They're dying out of the water. And a little way down the beach, an old woman's walking along the shoreline, and she's picking up one starfish after another, throwing them back into the sea. And the man approaches her and says, "What are you doing? You know, look at the starfish. There's thousands and thousands. You can't make any difference, given the number of starfish on the beach." At which point the old woman continues her actions and says, "Oh yeah, but I can make a difference to this one, and this one, and this one." So even small acts will make a difference. And as the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, "Do not underestimate good, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise man, little by little, fills himself with good." So, having thought about Kobe's circle of concern and influence, I was inspired to extend the idea to consider how we can perform deeds of loving kindness throughout our different aspects of our life. And I came up with this wonderfully original concept called circles of living kindness, which I've since realised are uncannily close to the stages of metta-bhavana. So I'm not sure it's quite as original as I thought. But I'll crack on anyway. So the first of the circles of loving kindness, the innermost circle of loving kindness, is ourself. Because obviously we're all at the centre of the universe. Or is that just me? Maybe. It's just me. As the Buddha taught, there is great value in looking after ourself, in applying self-metta. After all, it's no good taking on the bodhisattva vow, working towards enlightenment for all beings, if we end up completely exhausted and bedridden. So it's important to treat ourselves with loving kindness, to maintain our strength, both physically and spiritually. We all need to look after our health, watch what we eat, maintain our friendships, and set up the right conditions to support our Buddhist practice. Subhadramati says in Not Being About Being Good Again, "Committing to the precepts means cultivating mindfulness so that you don't let yourself get to breaking point where you think, that's it, I've had enough of trying to be skillful. Committing to the precepts means resolving to put yourself in conditions that support you to keep them. It's worth considering this, as often we don't realise just how much conditions influence us." So please bear that in mind throughout the rest of the talk. I'm going to explore how we can extend loving kindness to wider and wider aspects of our lives, but always bear in mind that we do need to be kind to ourselves and to treat ourselves with loving kindness. So having looked after number one, the next circle of loving kindness is concern for our family, which is a natural way for most people to extend beyond themselves to care about those nearest and dearest to them. Be it aged parents, siblings, or children, there is usually a natural affinity and responsibility for their well-being that transcends our very narrow concerns for self and begins to empathise with the concerns for others. So one of my dear friends in the Sangha, a family man with a young family, captured this well when we were discussing our shared experiences bringing up small children. He observed that your sense of self is broken down when it's 4 o'clock in the morning, you're up for the third time that night because your child is being sick, you need to change the bedclothes yet again, and she needs comforting because she's distraught and confused. And at that point, your dearest wish is to be snuggled up fast asleep, ready for the next day, but it goes out of the window. You respond without regard to yourself, and you respond for the benefit of another. And again, the Buddha captures this heartfelt concern for another being when he exhorts us to treat others as if they were our own child. Like a mother who protects her child, her only child, with her own life, one should cultivate a heart of unlimited love and compassion towards all living beings. So let's now extend our circle of loving kindness out further, and it's to friends and other people that we know. And this is a significant step because we're now moving away from our narrow area of self-interest, which arguably our relationship with our family still covers, to really start thinking about the needs and desires of others, other people. As Blake is quoted as saying, the most sublime act is to put another before yourself. And there is a real challenge to act in ways that affirm another person's being rather than deny it. Because quite often when we deal with other people, we're still concerned with ourselves. However subordinate the motive, there will always be a little ulterior motive to get noticed for doing something nice, hoping to be popular, thinking that if I do this act of loving kindness for someone, then maybe they'll repay me in some other way. So the challenge is to really empathise with that person, to imaginatively identify with that other person, and really try to understand what their real needs and desires are. After all, we don't always know what someone else wants. As George Bernard Shaw says, twisting the golden rule a bit, do not do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They may not have the same tastes. It's a humorous point, but a relevant one, because to truly deal with another person with loving kindness, we must be aware of their true needs rather than what we think they might want. Subhadramati, I'm struggling with that name, Subhadramati says, again, acting in accordance with this precept, which underpins all the others, means giving complete space to the other person and allowing them to be themselves. It means not taking advantage of others because you have more knowledge or experience. It means not trying to force or manoeuvre the situation. It means trying to generate a response of loving kindness that will remain undisturbed whoever we meet and whatever state they are in. A response of loving kindness that will be undisturbed whether or not we agree with the person or even like them. Now that's a challenge. Showing loving kindness to a person we don't really like. Or showing loving kindness when you don't agree with them. That's just off the chart. Anyway, acting with such loving kindness towards others has huge benefits for the other person, but also for ourselves. As George Saunders says in his book, Kindness Goes Viral, the world responds to you differently if you go out thinking, all right, I'm going to pretend that everybody out there is my brother or my sister. And if they are temporarily behaving like they're not, I'm going to pretend that they're just confused. I'm going to insist through my mannerisms and my tone of voice that I see them at their highest. And I'm sure you've all experienced that. When we're in a positive frame of mind and treat people with love and respect, they respond positively, treat us with kindness in return, and our whole relationship spirals upwards. We shouldn't underestimate the impact we have by living in the world with that positive attitude. Family, friends, people we know, even strangers, will notice, will respond, will begin to emulate our approach, and our impact, our circle of influence, will grow. here. So that's dealing with friends and other people. But one aspect of dealing with other people I'd just like to briefly explore is a tendency in our world that has been labelled othering. Treating other people as others, as not quite the same as us, as not so worthy, as inferior in some way. And we can see it in the news and in society's attitude towards Muslims, Jews, benefit claimants, the homeless, other nations. And this attitude helps us distance ourselves from them so that we can treat them as something less than human, justifying actions that are usually driven by great greed or hatred. And from a Buddhist perspective, we can see that this is just a reinforcement of self, a protection of our narrow view of the world, a building of barriers to protect ourselves. Whereas the first precept encourages us to reach out with loving kindness to all beings. We are taught that there is no difference between us and other beings, that we all want to be happy and avoid suffering, and indeed that we are all interdependent. That someone else's suffering is as important as our own. So that brings me on to the next layer in my circle of loving kindness. We're up to number 4 now. It's our approach to the wider society. We're all aware of the many problems in our society, the inequality and division, the breaking down of community, the increasing hatred between people, the rampant consumerism leading to exploitation of our natural resources. As before, the list is endless. Many of these problems are systemic, driven by institutional greed, hatred and delusion. So what can we do? Well, there's actually a real danger that we don't do anything. As David Loy, the American Buddhist teacher and author, explained in a recent talk called A Crisis for Buddhism, there are potentially two unhelpful attitudes in Buddhism that can prevent us from getting involved. The first is what he terms cosmological dualism, the idea that there's another reality and we can just transcend this life and sort of escape this world and its suffering. And then there is individual salvation, where we see the suffering in the world, but we retreat into ourselves, we work on our own minds and attitudes, and to some degree accept the situation is inevitable, but just work within ourselves. But in both cases, what this does not encourage is trying to transform this world to address the many causes of social dukkha. So if doing nothing is not acceptable, then what can we do? I remember a question that we were asked on a recent Bodhisattva ideal retreat that stayed with me. To what extent do I believe the Dharma is the solution to the world's ills, and how do I act on that? So that's a good question to reflect on. To what extent do I believe the Dharma is the solution to the world's ills, and how do I act on that? And on reflection, I passionately believe that in the Dharma we do have a solution to the world's problems, and that we should be making every effort to share the teachings, both directly and through how we engage with the world. As Subhuti states in his paper, The Buddhist Manifesto, the ultimate aspiration of the Sangha is to turn society everywhere into a new society, to transform the whole world into the land of the Dharma, into a pure land. This means that once the environments have been established that support the lives and Dharma practice of the committed core, every effort will be given to transforming the surrounding society. This requires us to address very directly the situation all around us, actively seeking to change it for the better on the basis of the Dharma. Many, everywhere at this moment, suffer terribly through injustice, violence, poverty, exclusion and prejudice. It is our compassionate duty to help them escape their suffering now. This can be done in two ways, by giving them the direct material aid they need to meet their difficulties, and by helping them to help themselves in the future. Buddhists can do both. So that's Subhuti talking. So we do need to address these societal issues, to get engaged, make sure people hear our voice, take action to help resolve the unfairness, the hatred and the greed in our society. However, a vital part of this is how we as Buddhists relate to these issues. If we approach these challenges with anger and hatred, then we've actually lost touch with the Buddhist values of compassion and wisdom. And acting from a state of anger is self-defeating. As a famous Buddhist image tells us, acting angrily is like throwing hot coals at our adversary. Regardless of whether we hit them, we're sure to burn our own hands. So what we can do that is distinctly Buddhist is to approach the problem with an attitude of loving kindness. Some people might wonder whether an attitude of loving kindness towards all will make us too vulnerable in a harsh and difficult world. But Buddhism again teaches us that we mustn't let negative encounters defeat us by making us lose the precious peace and love for others that we have in our heart. We must take tough actions to address the world's challenges, but we must never do it out of hatred or anger. It may not be easy to maintain and generate loving kindness in the face of aggression, but it is the most worthwhile approach, the one that creates the least harm and heals the damages from past ills. After all, as the Buddha says, again in the Dhammapada, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. To treat society with loving kindness isn't an easy option, by the way. It's not some sort of airy-fairy cop-out. As Sharon Salzberg, an American author and meditation teacher, says, it isn't what it appears to be on the surface. It sounds like you're just going to give in and be sweet, not take a stand on things. But it's actually a really daring kind of political vision that this is a completely interdependent universe and everybody counts. And this action can be an important part of our spiritual practice. Thich Nhat Hanh, the well-known Buddhist monk and peace activist, was asked recently whether people needed to choose between being engaged in social change or working on personal and spiritual growth. His reply was, I think that view is rather dualistic. The practice should address suffering, the suffering within yourself and the suffering around you. They are linked to each other. When you go to the mountain and practice alone, you don't have the chance to recognise the anger, jealousy and despair that's in you. That's why it's good that you encounter people, so you know these emotions. So that's us solving all of society's ills, so world hunger and world peace, that's all cracked. But there's still one more circle of loving kindness I want to look at. That's how we approach the challenges facing our planet in the face of devastating environmental change or damage. In the first precept, we vow to cherish all life on earth and not support any acts of killing. So we must start learning how to live in such a way that there is a future for all living beings, including our children and our grandchildren. If we continue to live as we have been living, consuming without thought to the future, destroying our forests and emitting greenhouse gases, then devastating climate change is inevitable. And as we reflect on the Dharma, we can recognise the interdependence of all things and understand that the suffering of other beings impacted by climate change is the same as our own suffering. We have a responsibility to treat others with loving kindness. Other humans living in areas of the world already devastated by global warming, other species that share this planet that are facing extinction, and future generations that are depending on us to maintain the planet for the future. As Thich Nhat Hanh says again, Buddhism came to life so we could learn to live with responsibility, compassion and loving kindness. Every Buddhist practitioner should be a protector of the environment. We have the power to decide the destiny of our planet. If we awaken to our true situation, there will be a collective change in our consciousness. We have to do something to wake people up. We have to help the Buddha wake up the people who are living in a dream. To that end, a lot of what we do is already acting towards the world with loving kindness. As Subhuti says in his Buddhist Manifesto paper again, Buddhists can demonstrate a genuinely alternative way of life that lives lightly on the planet, and that is more truly satisfying than the deliberately stimulated discontent that is the fundamental basis of our present system. So our tendencies as Buddhists towards a less materialistic lifestyle, towards vegetarianism, towards sustainability, they're all major steps in the right direction. And as I've said before, leading these simple, contented lives will influence others to adopt similar lifestyles. And we can all make our own best decision, our own decision on how best to address these big global issues. It doesn't necessarily mean becoming a climate activist, going on marches, working on conservation projects, or taking any sort of direct action. It may mean teaching the Dharma, knowing that others could be inspired to lead a simple, sustainable life. Or it may mean just making changes to our own lives to reduce our own carbon footprint and limit the negative impact we have on the environment. Whether that's going vegan, refusing to fly, switching to a renewable energy supplier, there are lots of options we should be considering. The key is to be aware of the challenges facing our world and, based on the wisdom of the Dharma, decide what changes we can make in our lives. So that leads me neatly onto my final topic, that's the circles done by the way, which is the Cambridge Sangha Action Group that I helped to run with Julietta, because it's a forum for exploring exactly these issues. Also, I thought when Ratnagosha asked me to give this talk, he would have expected me to use this opportunity to promote the group, so I'm not going to disappoint him. So Cambridge Sangha Action is interested mainly in the last two of my circles of loving kindness, so namely the society and the earth. Well, that obviously touches on how we treat our own selves, our family and friends, and other people as well. Our strapline is connecting the world with love, and we want to explore how we as Buddhists can respond with loving kindness to the problems in society and our wider world. We meet on the third Friday of every month, and all in the Sangha are welcome. Our challenge, our mission if you like, is how to take the Dharma into social activism, so trying to empower individuals to promote communal change, which we think is a really valuable contribution that Buddhists can make. We have three main aims from any of our meetings. The first is acting for the benefit of all beings. So we want to try and encourage Sangha members to come together, to support each other, to engage in their altruistic feelings and approaches to the world's problems. Secondly, we want to actually build Sangha and then reach out from that building. So we provide a forum for Sangha members who are interested in taking social action together, enabling to promote and facilitate engagement in any altruistic projects that they're interested in or find about. And then thirdly is education and reflection. So we just support each other to understand how our Buddhist values can help us to respond more wisely and compassionately to the range of issues, the global and local ones that I've been talking about. So one thing to emphasise, by the way, is that although we are keen to promote the Sangha reaching out into the world, we don't want people to be put off by the word action in Cambridge Sangha Action. It's not obligatory to get involved in any of the activities that we run. What we'd really like is people to come along, get engaged, share their feelings, support each other, and help each other to just face up to the many challenges that the world presents. If you are at all interested, then one way to find out more about it is to sign up to our group email. We have a group email where we swap ideas, news about events, things that people are going on. I never want to miss an opportunity. I have a sign-up sheet here, so if anyone wants to sign up the sheet and get the emails, then join in, that would be great. Our next meeting is on Friday, June the 15th, when we'll be showing a film related to transforming self, transforming world, which is the theme of this year's Buddhist Action Month. It's always a Buddhist Action Month in June. And then our main event for the year, from a BAM point of view, Buddhist Action Month, is on Saturday, June the 30th, when we're having a festival day here at the centre, which is going to be exploring some of these issues. And the day is going to be a combination of meditation and puja, based around transforming self and world. some activity, which is probably going to be making ponchos, which are sort of is worn clothing for the homeless and for refugees in Calais, which should be a good fun activity. We've done it before, and it's a good way of getting to know people. And then we've also got four talks from some pretty inspiring people in the Sangha who are going to share their experience of voluntary work and how it helps them to engage with the bigger picture. So should be. Oh, and then finally, Holly's going to be organising a dance awareness evening. So just to finish it off, so that'll be party time by then. So please come along. We're just working out how we're going to publicise it, but it's Saturday, June 30th. Everyone's invited everyone to come along, so please come along. So finally, I thought I would just leave the final word to the Buddha, why not, who talks about the five precepts in the Abhisandha Sutta. And here's an extract where he describes the first precept. Now, there are these five gifts, five great gifts: original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated from the beginning, that are not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and Brahmins. Which five? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from taking life. In doing so, he gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. In giving freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless number of beings, he gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression. This is the first gift, the first great gift. What more can I say?